Hello and welcome everyone. I'm Arthur Noble from Knight Capital, and today you are listening to the Leaders of Growth podcast. This is the first and only podcast dedicated to scaling a company across Series A to C.
Let's dive right into it. Very much appreciate that you want to share your story, or it's exciting news from Paul. So yeah, maybe you can start with if you can share your background and yeah, how you relate to the topic, the company you had, and yeah, your entrepreneurial story basically.
Sure, I'll try to be as brief as possible. Hard to abridge like 15 years into a few sentences, but so I'm from California. Paul and I were actually roommates in college, and Paul actually started a company. He went to London, and I took a road trip from California to Costa Rica, bought a one-way ticket to Colombia to visit a girl. So I clearly made the best decision. Basically, you know, when I was living in Colombia, I had a terrible experience finding property. I was kind of taken advantage of by a real estate agent. There was, you know, an asymmetry of information, not a lot of access. And so that was kind of the intrinsic motivator for me to solve the problem of aggregating and consolidating the property market, first in Colombia, and then I ended up expanding it to the Brazil, because Brazil is just an enormous market. And so I wanted to focus on a market large enough to support venture capital. We bootstrapped the company for 2 years, didn't raise any capital. And then a shifting moment in the trajectory of the company was when I brought on two amazing angel investors, early stage investors that brought two things, I think, to the business. One, expertise in terms of how to raise stage financing, and two, deep operational expertise on how to execute and, you know, just build an amazing business. After that, we ended up raising our Series A from local investors, and then we piled on institutional capital, mainly global, you know, growth investors and hedge funds. And then, you know, then we ended up merging the company, and then we sold it. That transaction happened about a month and a half ago, 2 months ago. And it was a decade long journey. I think I learned a few things along the way, made a lot of mistakes.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, like talking about that. So the audience is a bit of founders and operators and enthusiasts, basically. I want to learn like what are the pitfalls when scaling a company. Can you maybe share a bit on like some of the mistakes, so to speak,
sure, or
like challenges you came across and how you dealt with it?
Yeah, I don't think we have enough time to cover all of them, but I'll tell you the things that come to mind. I think one thing that I really look back on, and you know, I really think about that kind of scale from 50 to 250 people, where you're hiring aggressively. I mean, at that point, we were hiring probably 10 to 20 people a month for a short amount of time. I will share with you one thing that I learned about that. I call it the stop and go strategy. And one of my investors, who was the founder of Mercado Libre — Mercado Libre is a $70 billion company today — and he was the founder, COO of Mercado Libre. He shared with me the stop and go strategy. The stop and go strategy, it's a simple kind of like, if you think about the stage of growth, like, you know, the early days, you're kind of wandering to find product market fit, and you need to keep your team super small because you need to be nimble because you're constantly pivoting and changing. And that's very stressful for a team larger than 6 to 8 people. Once you figure out your product market fit and, you know, you've nailed it, but you haven't scaled it yet, that is when you want to go into what I call the stop and go strategy. The stop and go strategy is accelerated hiring followed by extreme optimization of productivity. So I think a lot of companies make the mistake where they accelerate hiring forever, and then they don't like calibrate, and they don't, you know, adjust and make sure. So I can see if I can find it here. I'll show you a graph that highlights this, but that's one thing I would say. Kind of tangentially connected to that, another thing that I would identify as something important in that process of 50 to 250, I think that when you've got venture capital, you've got fuel to gas to throw on the fire, you end up potentially — I particularly lost sight of like reminding people about the mission and becoming more kind of like just only focused on the numbers and like growth, where you have a tendency to forget about why you're building the business. And externalizing that, externalizing it to every stakeholder, because ultimately that's a motivating factor for people, is you know, what the objective for what you're building is. And so I think that that's something that I wish that I would have done better. And I think that all founders need to kind of pay attention to.
I think that's very valuable advice. Okay, maybe share a bit, like you mentioned about this strategy. What is the moment you basically define to calibrate? Are there principles one could define? And how long do you take for calibration? Because there is always this pressure for growth and for speed. On the other hand, you want to balance it. But how do you keep that balance?
So the question is, how do you balance for speed and growth with the kind of the not making everything fall apart or what?
So you take this moment to calibrate. And once you hired some people, is there some sort of principle how fast you should calibrate? Because if you calibrate too long, you might basically lose out on growth.
Yeah, I mean, I think that like everything should be uncomfortable all the time. So just like get comfortable with the discomfort of, you know, you should be growing fast enough that it's super uncomfortable and you should be able to be willing to calibrate so you're able to make marginal gains and in productivity. So like you should define what you're happy with and what you're okay with not having perfect. I don't think that there's a science to it. I think it's an art. What I would just advise is that like if you focus on growth without productivity, you're going to have a super unproductive, you know, but if you overly focus on productivity, you're not going to have enough growth. So I think that each founder needs to calibrate based on runway, based on, so there's, I think, a handful of extenuating factors that would impact what's the right calibration. But I would say that like, if you're comfortable with the growth, you're probably calibrating too much. That would be my measuring stick.
Yeah, interesting. And on productivity, do you look to revenue per employee or do you look more like on an individual, basically team basis?
Yeah, I think revenue per employee is a metric that we all looked at, like as we were growing the business. We constantly monitored that and we wanted to see that going in the right direction, obviously. There can be patches of that going in a different direction. Just make sure you understand why you're doing that and what the outcome of it is, and make sure you have a handle on your metrics, right? If you're not measuring, then you won't know if it's the right thing for your business. It's hard to give very blanketed advice for every company because every startup has a different mode. But I do think that like that was something we had in all of our board decks was revenue per headcount, like per employee. Like it was just something that we looked at and we saw that getting better over time. I don't think we ever like went backwards on that. Probably in the early days when we overhired, we kind of, you know, had a big surge in hiring. I always kind of felt like whenever we did that, I got a little bit like depressed because I felt like we were wasteful. And so there's a balance of like, you know, I don't think we were being totally wasteful, but you had to strike the balance of like, you know, making sure that you're going fast enough where I guess the comfort is the best measuring stick that's, you know, that I can use. But yeah, I think revenue per employee, let me think about other metrics that are, yeah, I would say on a unit economic basis too, for like depending on your product, you know, and just making sure that like unit economics aren't getting like dramatically worse. Like that would be a bad sign if you're doubling down on a ton of things and then your economics are going in the wrong direction. So I think that you need to find those, you know, key KPIs that determine the growth and health of the business. And, you know, you need to boil that down into a balsamic reduction sauce of what's important. And I would say that in the early days, when you're looking for product market fit, it's one metric that matters. And it's an obsession about that. But when you get a little bit bigger, you can't beat the dials on the video game. There's multiple dials on the video game. And so you need to make sure that you're hitting all the dials and you're not dialing up one thing that's negatively impacting the other thing. So founders need to take inventory of what those dials are and probably don't want to have too many dials. But you don't want to have just one dial because you could be affecting some, you know, other negative metric.
Yeah, and really perceive it as a system rather than an individual part.
Correct.
Something which I found very interesting in your background is that you, like as a fast-growing company, that you did like an M&A, that you acquired a company. I was quite interested to understand a bit like what are the drivers for like what you think makes sense for a company to do an M&A when they are a startup.
Looking back, I don't think that like we had any extremely transformative M&A except for when we merged with our competitor, which was pretty transformative because it led to a liquidity event. But I think the M&A opportunities that I think are interesting are at the mid-tier kind of growth stage. Acqui-hires are an underutilized strategy, and acquiring teams that you know, fill a void in your company rather than like some kind of like complex merger. I would shy away from that, most complex mergers, unless you're like a super M&A team, because typically when you're a Series B company, you don't have like a corporate development arm built. You don't have like all of the muscles that you need in order to be effective and be acquisitive. So I would say smaller acquisitions are on the table. And I would probably, despite, you know, the only exception I would consider is there's certain types of businesses where like the industrial logic, like a marketplace business where you lock supply or you just can, those are, you know, I think you can be acquisitive and maybe someone way bigger than you. One of my investors told me early on, there was a competitor that was 10 times larger than us when after Series A. And he was like, go try to buy them. And I went and I approached them and they completely like scoffed at the idea and like were kind of offended by the idea. But that same player we ended up merging with on almost a 50-50 deal three or four years later. So that was like kind of just setting your ambition, you know? So like, I wouldn't say spending a ton of time on that, but like set your ambition high if you are going to, you know, look to consolidate a market, right? But I would typically shy away from complex M&A early on and, you know, more when you're a consolidated company. I think that product-oriented team acquisitions can be a nice accelerator for talent.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So if normally you see with M&A for large companies, we also buy a bit of like a revenue source that can tap into. This is more basically to strengthen your product and to get high sought after talent. So you get new people in there. How do you basically get them into the culture of the business? Because they have like a different reference point. How do you get them led to be also be productive and not only stay for a minimum point of time and then leave?
I think that it's about investing the time up front. And not doing that afterwards. So like there just might be a company that just you don't think will work well unless they have some piece of tech that you can really use or leverage. I think that like investing the time ahead of time to like build the relationship, simulate what it's going to be like working with them and make sure that there's a fit there is better spent prior to executing a transaction than, you know, if you're just trying to buy somebody.
Yeah, exactly. And that's both with the founder as maybe the influential people in the company that you basically acquire.
Exactly. Yes. Just put the time in, and try to minimize the surprises, right? By investing up front.
No, definitely. Now, I had once like on the sideline, I heard from a company they were acquired and people internally were asking what's going to happen with the culture. And the acquirer said, you can sell the culture on eBay. that company didn't last longer than 6 months.
Yeah. Makes sense.
Hey, is there anything that you like to share with founders and operators that you think is worth sharing that they did not ask for?
Yeah. I mean, I think that like, running an efficient board is something important, right? At this stage. Like I feel like early stage entrepreneurs, when they raise their first capital, they're like constantly selling their board, right? Like, and like every board meeting is like, look how great we're doing. And so first of all, I'm hoping that when founders read this book and they've raised Series B or Series C, that they have good investors on board, right? Because if you don't have good investors on board, this advice won't help you. But I would say, you know, founders that are super experienced, the investors that are super experienced as founders, they don't really become alarmed by most things, right? So like when something goes wrong in your business, I feel like I've seen so many different things now that the pattern recognition and like, I'm not shocked when something happens, right? Because I've usually seen it before or I can imagine it or I experienced it myself. So I guess that, you know, running efficient boards, like it's about having highly engaged board members that you don't have to be selling your investors now. You should be finding out what their strengths are and how they can facilitate and ask specific action items from your board. Like if someone has some expertise or some network that you need access to, I see a lot of founders like send an email to their board and ask for help on something. And that's like, that never gets responded because board members are on, if you're a VC or you're an investor or you're an independent board member, you're likely on multiple boards. And so ask for specific action items of things that you want from your board to deliver on for you. and single people out and ask them to deliver. That's something that is underutilized strategy for leveraging your assets you have. That's one thing. What else? I would say deeply engage your management team with the board. Typically, early stage founders, they're like me at the center. They're presenting the entire board meeting. Have your VP of sales present. You don't need to drone on a long time about what the business and the KPIs, but like this serves two functions. One thing it does is that it creates a better connection with the management team, or the management team feels more important. They feel like they're like connected to these investors and that it's like a new world for them. It's new, a new entry point to their career. And then two, it's easier for the board to help when they understand the people and what they need. And it also just like boards typically don't know the details of the business. So it allows them to have a little bit deeper connection with the management team. I see too many boards where management team is so completely removed from the investors and the investors don't know the management team. So I think that at Series B, if you're the CEO and you're talking more than, 40% at the board meeting, you probably need to make room for your team.
I really like that. I also like the percentage. It's never going to be like a golden rule, but it definitely shows something that it's not only your show, and it also shows like whether you can really delegate.
Exactly. I mean, if you're going to try to scale the company, you got to stop doing everything yourself. And so founders have like an obsession with a lot of times, like they don't let go very well. And if you found smarter people than you to execute on what you're building, then you should give them the platform to share. And I think that it serves an amazing motivator for the employees too, because they want, the management wants to feel ownership of what they're building. And so give them ownership.
Yeah, I also really like it. Like, for instance, sometimes like I as an investor have questions on, for instance, sales. If I always have to go through the founder as a board member, that's not always very helpful because like he might not be or she might not be the person that knows most about it. Not to exclude the founder, but just to have like this direct conversation and that there is actually enough trust to get a work on something that you can let go rather than that you have to control a relationship.
Yeah, I think that is a sign of a healthy board, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
Another suggestion I have is that this is a little more complicated in COVID times, but like if you're doing in-person board meetings, I would do a dinner beforehand, before your board meetings, just to have like a sync up and a connection with the board.
Thank you for listening. Don't forget to subscribe. I'm looking forward to seeing you next time.